Struggle for the liberation of Palestine has been long, complex, and difficult. Attention most often has focused on viewpoints of those dominating the Palestinian people, those building a colonial settler state on Palestinian land. Attention sometimes has focused on the injustices and suffering experienced by the indigenous Palestinian people, but hardly at all has attention focused on the Palestinian people's own political efforts and organization to achieve their liberation. To explore this aspect, we contacted Tofiq Haddad, a Bethlehem-based American Palestinian. He is a researcher for the Palestinian organization Badil and a journalist for the online newspaper Faster Times. He also is co-author with Israeli activist Tikva Parnas of the book Between the Lines. Red Eye Collective member Mordecai Breenberg recorded an interview with Tofiq that covered the period from the 1930s to the Oslo Agreement in the early 1990s. A concluding part of the interview from the Second Intifada to the present will be broadcast in October. In the part we broadcast this morning, Mordecai began by asking Tofiq what happened in the aftermath of the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe in English, the period of Zionist ethnic cleansing of Palestine in the late 1940s?
That's obviously a big question, but I think the Nakba, the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in the 47 to 49 period, essentially did away with the old traditional leadership that was proved itself ineffective in leading the Palestinians, or at least stopping what was the Zionist militia's intentions to kick the Palestinians out. So there was no organized leadership, really, at the time. And actually, even to put that into consideration, even a lot of the Palestinian leadership had been exiled previous to that in the 36 to 39 rebellion, which took place. So the Nakba takes place in a context of already sort of like a lack of leadership. It's called the Nakba largely because it was catastrophic for Palestinians, including on the political leadership level. And for that reason, it took several years before there were any buds of reorganization taking place. The larger Arab-Israeli conflict, as it's known, was the most dominant thing at the time. In that respect, the Palestinian national movement was sort of subsumed beneath a larger Arab-Israeli conflict, and for that reason, if there was any organization as far as Palestinians were concerned, it was probably taking place in places like Gaza in the early 50s, who were began to be a part of what was at the time Egyptian control over Gaza, particularly after 52, when Nasser, since the revolution takes place in Egypt, and by 54, you have Palestinians actually becoming part of and being trained by Egyptian troops inside Gaza, here and there doing like random what are known as Fedayeen raids. But the post-war period is largely characterized by a period of desperation, depression, demoralization, and there was no independent Palestinian sort of politics really going on. It was sort of in process, shall we say. And in that regard, the two major political elements that began to emerge from the diasporic communities, the communities of refugees who were kicked out, developed two different political streams, shall we say. The refugees who ended up in places like Lebanon and Syria began getting involved in like pan-Arabist politics and leftist politics and reforming the Arab nationalist movement, involved in universities up there. And that political formation eventually later on becomes the Palestinian left in its different formations. At the same time, many of the refugees who ended up in Gaza or in Egypt, as well as the Gulf states, formed the basis or the nucleus, shall we say, from which Fatah emerged. And these were people who actually were also involved in student politics in getting their education in Egypt and then going to places like the Gulf and organizing Palestinians there. Some of them had been members of the Islamic Brotherhood, which was sort of the part of the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, which is largely under the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood at the time. But these elements were actually dissatisfied with the Brotherhood's position on Palestine and were seeking ways to sort of break off the Palestinian movement into a more pronounced nationalist stream as opposed to one that was directly linked with the Arab nationalist movement. And the window for that opportunity to take place when Palestinian nationalism actually breaks away from the larger Arab-Israeli conflict, of course, takes place in 1967 when the Arab Nationalist Project is defeated in what's known as in the June War, where Israel essentially launches a unilateral aggressive war against Egypt at the time and also Jordan and Syria. And so but that's another topic, I would say.
So the Palestine Liberation Organization, is it an amalgam then of the two streams you've identified from the different diasporic communities, the different groupings of people who've been exiled in the ethnic cleansing of the establishment of the State of Israel?
Yes, that's correct. The PLO was actually formed in 1964 as a way it was formed by Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian president at the time, as a way for him to sort of keep control over what was emerging rebelliousness amongst the Palestinian refugee population, which were under his command or control, let's say, in the Gaza Strip. And they were, you know, the Palestinians in Gaza were, you know, increasingly, you know, seeking to sort of take up arms, to take their own cause in their own hands, and to not have it subsumed beneath the larger Arab-Israeli conflict to some extent. So essentially, with the defeat of Nasserism in 1967, you had the entire Arab world was demoralized and disoriented, shall we say, but this, in a way, created the space for the Palestinian nationalist movements, which were in incubation in these different areas, to sort of come to the forefront. I might add, though, that the reality was they were not entirely prepared for this task at the time. They were sort of thrown very fast into the limelight. The Arab governments were, to some extent, pleased with their ability, with the emergence of these guerrilla groupings, because it helped to sort of mollify or assuage the Arab defeat at the time. And these great myths of the Fida'i figure, the self-sacrificing Palestinian fighter who was recruited from the camps of diaspora and who was now willing to engage in struggle, armed struggle against Israel, was sort of a strong palliative to this sort of very depressing time when things were in the post-67 period. But that level of disorganization and whatnot would eventually, I think, catch up with the PLO in different respects. But in any regard, that is the basis of what is known as the modern PLO, and that certainly was also a seminal moment, because once Palestinian organizations were able to take over the PLO for themselves and set it according to their criteria, it began a whole new trajectory of dynamics and developments, both positive as well as negative, I might add. But that sort of gives some context to the PLO, I would say.
What could you tell us a bit about that evolution? Because the PLO is largely, in my impression, based outside of the territories controlled by Israel through its two wars of the establishment of the state in 48-49 and the conquest of the remaining 22% of historic Palestine in 1967.
Of course, the PLO was located outside of for most of its history. It was formed, as I said, in 64, actually, in the West Bank, before the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And for many years, it did lead a relatively successful program of on different levels. I mean, certainly on the internal Palestinian front, it played a huge role in sort of galvanizing and crystallizing a Palestinian national identity around some basic principles. And it was also largely a part of some of the revolutionary struggles at the moment that were going on in the late 60s, and it was able to slowly but surely, after years, gain legitimacy on an international stage, as well as in the Arab arena, which was quite crucial. But it's also something to take into consideration here. It was not a given that the PLO would be the representative of the Palestinian people. That that recognition was nominally achieved in 1974 at what's known as the Rabat Conference. But actually, you still had things like the Jordanian regime trying to intervene on behalf of the Palestinians, and Israel trying to have the Jordanian regime, as well as the Egyptian regime, to represent Palestinians, because they would rather make deals with Arab states as opposed to in exchange for peace agreements, than as opposed to recognizing or dealing with the Palestinian national leadership, which was calling for things like independence and right of return and things like this. The PLO only is able to actually come to the West Bank and Gaza with the onset of the Oslo Accords. But that has its own particularities to it. The PLO by that point had largely was a shell in many ways of its former self, or had been forced to accept many compromises, shall we say. And but can you please tell me, Mordechai, what specifically about this the dynamic of the outside inside that you would like me to address?
Well, even you mentioned Oslo, and in the late we have the PLO largely based, as you say, outside historic Palestine, engaged in its political struggles and sometimes military struggles. In the late 80s, 88, 89, a movement called the First Intifada arises in the West Bank and Gaza among the population there, which takes on its own dynamic, but which is internal to historic Palestine and engages masses of people. And then there's an Oslo Accord, which seems to be negotiated by the PLO from outside, and that sort of changes again the dynamic of where leadership, initiative, and perspective on how to advance the liberation struggle, this is sort of conflicting trends. So maybe you could talk about how that Oslo Accord impacted on the development internal to historic Palestine, West Bank, and Gaza parts of a new Palestinian initiative and mass movement, and the political forces that arise then.
Sure. Well, you're correct. Let's put it in perspective a little bit. In 1967, right after the war, the PLO at the time and Arafat actually tried to organize locally in the West Bank, but there was those efforts were actually unsuccessful, and all those cells that were set up were actually quite quickly found out and given up, shall we say. The reality was that the population in the West Bank at the time, which had its own dynamics as a result of living underneath the Jordanian regime and the Egyptians, was not prepared and was not fully aware of who these groupings were and whatnot. And they had also just seen Israel defeat three major Arab armies, and so they weren't about to sort of just immediately swear loyalty to the PLO when they didn't know who these guys were, and when it was the first time that they were living under occupation as well. But by the mid-70s, the Palestinians in the occupied territories embraced the PLO as the national leadership, and this was a clear seminal moment that took place. And for years, consciously and till today embraces the PLO as the, for the most part, as the sole representative of the Palestinian people. This was an important position for them to take because, as I said, there were Israeli designs to try and formulate other leaderships, as I said, to either deal with the Jordanian, have the Jordanians administer the West Bank for the Israelis, or the Egyptians in Gaza, or actually there were efforts in the later 70s to try and establish a kind of a collaborator network, similar to what Americans have been trying to establish in Iraq. But with historical developments, particularly, the PLO had been kicked out of Jordan, and then in 1982 it was kicked out of Lebanon and was forced to go to Tunisia. And running a liberation organization from an area that was hundreds of miles away, to some extent distanced the political leadership from the local development of the Palestinians on the ground underneath occupation, and what at the time was almost 20 years of occupation. So you had an emergent Palestinian leadership coming from the occupied West Bank, and they began, now it's important to say that they were loyal and saw the PLO leadership outside as their leadership without question. But at the same time, the distance and the daily needs forced and resulted in a local leadership, which at one point leads to the First Intifada. This was obviously a very inspiring moment. It was a popular resistance campaign. The society had been mobilized and organized. A lot of the mass mobilization of and politicization of Palestinians had taken place in the early 80s, where the PLO actually began to have more of a mass-based political project. And those leaders that came out of the school of that political organizing of within the universities in the early 80s, together with a major prisoner release agreement in 1986, resulted in a very strong organic leadership, which led the First Intifada. Now, within a year of that popular uprising exploding, you had the PLO national leadership in Tunisia quickly trying to begin to coordinate with it and make sure that it was not going to break away from its larger struggle with and political diplomatic game that the PLO was playing on the international stage. But the reality was the Intifada, there were grave attempts to kind of suppress it. At the same time, you had things like the first Gulf War, where the PLO took a major hit and the PLO leadership committed major strategic errors by siding with the Iraqi regime. This resulted in the expulsion of the Palestinian communities in the Gulf, which were about 500,000 people, the drying up of those financial resources that those Palestinians used to provide. You also had the collapse of the Soviet Union. You had the rise of a unipolar world. And the PLO leadership was essentially in a position where it was not on the territorial border of Palestine. It was far weaker politically and strategically. So this created the environment within which the PLO began thinking and actually operating in terms of making a deal with Israel. Now, since the early 70s, the PLO leadership had abandoned any kind of idea of winning Palestinian liberation in one go. It argued through different means at different stages that that Palestinian liberation would come in stages, and one of the first things that they needed to get was to actually get some kind of Palestinian authority or entity on parts of territorial Palestine. Now, the need for this was actually to some extent understandable and justifiable in this, to the extent that organizing constantly in an environment where it's not your land, whether you're in Jordan, whether you're in Lebanon, whether you're in Tunisia, always made the Palestinian movement susceptible to interference from Arab governments who were had a whole host of own political considerations that were not necessarily, that didn't necessarily put Palestine first. So the PLO leadership argued and largely won over most elements of the Palestinian different parties to say that, look, we need to try and push for a state in Palestine, or at least some kind of entity. There were different arguments about what kind of entity and what kind of compromises would have to be accepted, but this was always argued as part of the staged project towards liberation. And that's the birthplace of the Oslo Accords, essentially, where in September 1993, after secret negotiations took place in Oslo, the PLO essentially recognizes Israel, and Israel recognizes the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. But it's important to point out there, they were only recognizing the PLO as the representatives of the people. They weren't recognizing the PLO or any Palestinian national political rights. What they were agreeing to was essentially an open-ended kind of timetable to discuss things in negotiations, when the reality was the imbalance or asymmetry of forces and powers between the two was astronomical. In addition to the fact that there was simply some very poor negotiating done on behalf of the Palestinians in terms of what they accepted in the agreement. I mean, the issue of settlement expansion was to some extent allowed under the Oslo Accords. The word occupation is not even mentioned there. The reality was Israel had an entirely different conception about what these accords were. They saw in them the ability to continue their colonial eating up of the West Bank and Gaza, and to integrate those areas into Israel. Into Israel, and at the same time get a what they call a Palestinian partner to do this administrative job of taking care of the Palestinian population, because simply they didn't want to have to deal with that. There was always a contradiction in the fact that Israel, which always pretended to be the Jewish democratic state, this contradiction was that if they continue to hold on to this, what is today 2.6 million Palestinians, actually no, 3.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank, this would, if they gave them citizenship, this would erode the quote Jewish character of the state, and if they didn't give them citizenship, it would erode the democratic nature of the state. So their solution, which is basically known as the Alon Plan, was to essentially find some kind of body or entity to administer these areas, but not really give these areas genuine sovereignty or whatnot. The Palestinians on their side thought that the Oslo Accords could get this limited autonomy that they could get from the Accords could form the basis of a future state. So this is the contradictions of what Oslo brought about, and as I said, it was largely the major power imbalances that essentially saw Israel going about continuing its colonization, not interested in the creation of an independent Palestinian state or fulfillment of Palestinian national objectives, and eventually the negotiations collapsing and another intifada breaking out.
That was the first part of a two-part interview by Red Eye Collective member Mordecai Breenberg with Tofik Haddad. A concluding part of the interview from the second intifada to the present will be broadcast in October. Tofik Haddad is a Bethlehem-based American-Palestinian. He is a researcher for the Palestinian organization Badil and a journalist for the online newspaper Faster Times. He is also co-author with Israeli activist Tikva Parnas of the book Between the Lines.